When you picture a crisis, your brain probably cues up, I don't know, an action movie.
Right, like an explosion or something.
Exactly. You instantly imagine blaring red alarms, people sprinting down fluorescent lit hallways, split second choices, adrenaline.
Oh, yeah, total chaos.
We have this deeply ingrained cultural expectation that when things are uncertain, there has to be this massive amount of noise and visible movement.
Which makes sense. I mean, the modern world really conditions us to think of the apocalypse in high definition.
Totally.
We assume if we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, a visible threat must be erupting right in front of us today.
But today, in this deep dive, we are looking at a crisis captured on a literal 15 by 11 inch piece of paper.
It's so small.
Right. And it shows us that real, paralyzing uncertainty isn't an explosion at all. It is an endless, silent waiting room.
The psychological reality of vulnerability is mostly just waiting. It really is.
And to truly understand the architecture of that waiting room, we're looking at a specific piece of art today. It's an October 2022 watercolor painting by the artist Jairo Duque.
Which is such a brilliant piece to analyze.
It is. The painting is quite literally titled Incertidumbre, which translates to uncertainty. It belongs to his Cienega Grande series in a chapter he calls Pintura Urbana, or urban painting.
But I think, what's really cool is the source material we have for this.
Yeah, what makes the stack of sources for today's deep dive so unique is that we aren't just looking at the finished piece.
Right. We rarely get this much behind the scenes stuff.
We have Duke's exceptional notes, the highly specific technical specifications of his studio materials, and most intriguingly, honestly, a rather harsh, unsparing self-critique he wrote about his own work.
Having access to an artist's internal critique completely changes the way we can analyze the final product. I mean, it's rare.
Yeah, why is that so valuable?
Well, we get to see not just what he painted, but what he intended to paint, where he felt he failed,
Oh, interesting.
and how those perceived failures actually ended up reinforcing the psychological weight of the image.
So our mission today is to figure out exactly how Duke takes a flat, very small piece of paper and uses microscopic texture, visual weight, and his own self-reflection to translate the invisible, silent tension of human vulnerability into a tangible format.
It's a huge task for a piece of paper.
Okay, let's unpack this. Can you just set the scene of the painting for us?
Sure. So, to see how he builds this tension, we have to start with the environment he's chosen to paint. We are looking at a Palafitto.
And for anyone who doesn't know, what exactly is that?
Right. For anyone unfamiliar with the architecture of the region, a Palafitto is a traditional wooden house built on long stilts, elevated directly over a lagoon or a swamp.
So it's right on the water.
Literally on the water. It is a structure fundamentally built on a compromise with nature. You are living suspended above a fluid, totally unpredictable ecosystem.
Wow, just the structure alone sounds stressful.
Exactly. And in the doorway of this stilted house, Duke has painted three human figures.
What are they doing?
Nothing. They're simply standing there, looking out at the vastness of the water and the sky.
Wait, really? Nothing is happening?
No visible action. The air is still.
You know, I looked at these three figures for a long time trying to pinpoint the emotion, and I have to admit, my very first instinct was not existential crisis.
No.
No. I mean, if I see three people leaning in a doorway staring at a flat horizon, my brain initially codes that as like Sunday afternoon boredom.
Sure, that makes total sense.
I really struggled at first to see the line between people just killing time on a slow weekend and people trapped in uncertainty.
Well, the line separating boredom from uncertainty comes down entirely to agency and control.
Okay, break that down for me.
Boredom is a luxury, right? It happens in a secure environment where you have a multitude of choices, but you voluntarily choose inaction.
Oh, I see. Like, I could go to the store, but I'm choosing to sit here.
Exactly. You control the pause. In Duke's painting, the environment is what dictates the inaction.
Because they can't go anywhere.
Yeah, right. He builds this entire work around a concept he specifically labels the pause, a mandatory involuntary suspension of life dictated by massive, uncontrollable external forces.
Like waiting to see what the weather will do or if the tide is going to rise too high today.
Yeah, their daily survival depends entirely on variables they cannot influence.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. It could be a sudden shift in the climate, a drop in the fish population they rely on to eat, or even, distant political and economic decisions made in a concrete office hundreds of miles away that dictate the resources of their region.
So they're just stuck.
They are physically suspended over the water and psychologically suspended in time.
It's the physical embodiment of holding your breath. I mean, we've all experienced microversions of this.
Oh, for sure.
It's the physiological knot in your stomach when you are waiting for the results of a biopsy or waiting for an email to see if you got the job you desperately need to cover rent.
Right, you aren't doing anything physical.
Exactly. You are completely stationary. You are just sitting in a chair. But internally, the cognitive load is so massive that it leaves you exhausted.
And the cruelty of that exhaustion in the Cienaga is that it isn't temporary.
It doesn't just end after an email.
No, it's not a few hours in a doctor's office. It is the permanent baseline of their existence. That is the feeling Duke is attempting to construct. They aren't running from a visible monster. They are trapped in this pause, waiting to see what the environment decides to do with them today.
Which brings us to the visual construction of that trap, and a fascinating contradiction I found in Duke's own notes.
Oh, the self-critique.
Yeah. When he reviewed this piece, he criticized his own composition. He felt that the heavy wooden wall of the house, which sits on the right side of the painting, was way too visually dominant.
Right, he wasn't happy with it.
He wrote that he wished he had pulled it back and allowed more interaction with the open water on the left side, feeling that the wall was, like, suffocating the space.
I mean, it is a massive dark block of visual weight. If you look at the composition, it completely anchors the right side of the paper.
It really does.
It just refuses to let the viewer's eye move past it.
I was trying to describe how this visual weight feels, and the best analogy I can think of is being stuck on a seesaw.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah, like if you were at a playground and you weigh the exact same as the person on the other end, the seesaw rests at a perfectly balanced 50-50.
Right, it's stable.
It's predictable. You
Well,
have control over the momentum. But if
right.
the person on the other end weighs three times as much as you, you are violently shot to the top and left dangling in the air.
Ooh, yeah, you're just stuck up there.
You are entirely dependent on this heavy, immovable object to let you down. You are trapped by the imbalance.
That is the mechanics of how we view art actually support that analogy perfectly.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, Western viewers naturally read an image from left to right the same way we read text.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Yeah. Our eyes enter the painting on the left, scan across the open water, and then slam directly into that heavy wooden wall on the right.
It's like a brick wall for your eyes.
It acts as a visual dead end. Your eye hits it and cannot escape back out.
So his self-perceived error is actually doing all the psychological heavy lifting.
Absolutely. By every measure of traditional pleasing composition, he made a mistake. But for the narrative of uncertainty, it's a psychological triumph.
Because it feels wrong.
Right. If he had fixed it, if the painting was perfectly balanced, 50% wooden refuge and 50% open water, the visual stability would create a sense of peace.
It would just be a relaxing landscape painting at that point.
Exactly. But uncertainty is asymmetrical. The oppressive wall on the right creates an architectural feeling of entrapment, where the supposed refuge of the house actually feels claustrophobic.
It traps them.
It corners the figures, and by extension, it corners you as the viewer.
And right in the middle of all this heavy, suffocating stillness, there is one single element that breaks the rigidity.
The flag.
Yes. It's this small piece of cloth tied to a stick, waving diagonally in the wind. Duke's notes literally call this an ambiguous symbol.
Which is such a great phrase.
It is. Like, is it laundry drying out? Is it a warning flag about the water level? Or is it a marker to help someone find the house in a maze of palafitos?
He deliberately refuses to give the viewer a clear answer.
Why do you think he does that?
Because the ambiguity of the flag feeds directly into our own feeling of instability. It highlights the constant wearing force of the wind, but by not declaring a clear purpose, it forces our brain to keep scanning for a threat that we can't quite identify.
So if that massive woody wall physically traps our eye on the page, the way he actually paints the rest of the scene is what makes that trap feel so
It's a
authentic.
technique, yeah.
I was looking at the figures to see how he conveys the sheer stress of this environment, but nobody is crying. Nobody is screaming or pulling their hair out.
It's very subtle.
Yeah, the tension is entirely hidden in this one detail of how the main figure is leaning their weight against the wooden doorframe.
Duke refers to this as expressive containment.
Expressive containment, I love that.
It's so accurate. When you live in a state of chronic unpredictability, you don't have the energy for theatrics. The tension is carried entirely in the body language.
It's just baked into how they stand.
Right. That simple posture, leaning heavily against the doorframe, projects an immense silent exhaustion, but it also projects a stubborn resistance.
Like, I'm tired, but I'm not leaving.
Exactly. The doorframe is holding them up, but they are also refusing to move.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I noticed Duke was incredibly specific about his materials in his notes to achieve this gritty look.
Yes, the technical specs.
He didn't just grab a standard canvas or a random sketch pad. He insisted on Arches 300-gram cold-pressed paper and Daniel Smith brand watercolors.
Very specific choices.
At first, I understood the 300-gram part. I mean, it's thick paper, like cardboard almost, so the wet paint doesn't warp the page.
Right. Pretty standard for watercolor.
But for a painting about an intangible emotional state, why does the physical grit of cold-pressed paper matter so much?
Oh, it changes the entire physical reality of the emotion being portrayed.
How so?
Well, in the world of watercolor, hot-pressed paper is completely smooth, almost like glass.
Oh, okay.
It's perfect for highly controlled, artificial perfection, like hyper-realistic botanical illustration where every line needs to be razor-sharp.
But cold-pressed is different.
Very. Cold-pressed paper has a microscopic landscape of its own. It is rough. It is filled with tiny peaks and valleys. It has a porous, highly textured surface.
So the surface itself already has friction before you even apply paint.
Yes. And when you combine that textured surface with the specific chemistry of granulating watercolors like the Daniel Smith paints Duke explicitly mentions, something remarkable happens on a microscopic level.
What happens?
Granulating pigments don't just dye the paper evenly the way ink dyes a shirt. The pigment particles in these specific paints are unusually heavy. As the water evaporates on the paper, these heavy particles actually separate from the liquid and pool irregularly into the tiny valleys of that rough, cold-pressed paper.
So the paint is behaving like sediment, settling in a riverbed. It's literally falling into the cracks of the paper.
Yes. It's a literal, physical metaphor for the swamp.
Oh, wow.
The chemistry of the paint interacts with the topography of the paper to create organic chaos. Because of this, the sky and the water in the painting don't look artificial, plastic, or perfectly blended.
They look real.
They look earthy, gritty, and physically worn. The texture of the cold-pressed paper is translating the invisible, abrasive wear and tear of living in that environment into a tactile visual element.
You can practically feel the salt and the grit rubbing against the wood.
Exactly.
Now, the fact that the paper's texture is doing the work to anchor this painting in the gritty physical reality of a Colombian swamp makes Duke's own reference material incredibly confusing to me.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, I was digging through his notes, and I found out he didn't use a photograph of Colombia to build this scene.
Nope.
He used a reference photo from October 2022 taken in Whittier, California.
It's such a curveball.
I have to admit, when I saw he used a photo of a California suburb to capture the hyperlocal reality of the Chinaga Grande, I felt like the authenticity was completely diluted. It felt a bit like cheating, you know?
I had the exact same reaction when I first read that. It feels counterintuitive, right?
Totally.
If you were painting a Colombian swamp, why look at a photo of California real estate?
Exactly.
But what's fascinating here is, if you examine how a professional artist actually uses a reference, it becomes a masterclass in translation. Duke wasn't copying the houses or the streets of Whittier. He was borrowing the skeleton of an emotion.
Wait, what exactly is the skeleton of an emotion?
It's the underlying geometry of a feeling. He might have seen a specific slump of a shoulder in a pedestrian in that photograph, or the exact geometric angle of how harsh midday light casts a shadow across a piece of weathered wood.
Oh, I see.
He extracts that underlying physical structure, the anatomy of exhaustion or the physics of the light, and then he wraps it in the atmosphere, the color, and the granular texture of the Chinaga.
So he strips away the California context completely.
Yeah.
And just keeps the biological or physical truth of the image.
Exactly that. And the fact that he can pull the emotional truth from a photo of California and seamlessly apply it to a Colombian swamp actually proves the core thesis of his work.
Which is what?
That the physical manifestation of uncertainty, that heavy slump of the shoulders, that specific cast of a shadow, is entirely universal.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. He's translating the feeling, not the zip code.
Right.
But there was a second self-critique from Duke that I really want to unpack because it made me reconsider how we instinctively want to portray danger.
Oh, the note about the water.
Yes. Looking back at his painting, he wrote that he felt he should have given the water more tonal vibration.
Which basically means he thought he should have added more contrast, more visible movement, and darker shadows, rather than leaving the water so incredibly flat.
And my immediate thought was to agree with him. I mean, if the water is the massive, uncontrollable threat dictating their lives, wouldn't painting darker, more turbulent water make the stakes more obvious to the viewer?
It would make the stakes obvious, but it would completely destroy the psychological tension of the piece.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Duke is being overly critical of his own restraint here. If he had painted the water with heavy turbulence, white caps, and dark, aggressive tonal vibrations, he would have turned the painting into an action movie disaster scene.
Oh, we'd be right back to the blaring alarms and people running down hallways.
Exactly. The event would already be happening.
The crisis would have arrived.
Right. The doctor would have already walked into the waiting room and delivered the terrible news. At that point, you are no longer in the pause. You are in the reaction phase.
That is such a good point.
By actively keeping the watercolor washes broad, subtle, and flat, the threat remains entirely insidious.
Because flat water is hiding its intentions.
Yes. A storm is a visible enemy. If the water is turbulent, you know exactly what you are fighting, and you can brace for it.
You can prepare.
But the horror of a calm, flat, unreadable horizon is that the threat is entirely in your own head. It's the terror of a massive body of water that looks perfectly peaceful, but could quietly rise a meter in the middle of the night while everyone is sleeping.
That's terrifying.
Psychologically, navigating the silence of flat water is far more agonizing than enduring a loud storm.
Because with flat water, you are just waiting. The tension is all internal.
Yep.
And tracking the physical journey this painting took proves that this internal silent tension works on a global scale.
The exhibition history is wild.
It really is. According to the sources, this 15 by 11 inch piece of paper started its exhibition life in a gallery in Miami in May 2023.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, Miami has a strong built-in cultural and geographic connection to the Caribbean and Latin America, so that progression makes logical sense. But then in December 2024, via a platform called Artboxy, this painting takes a jarring leap across the planet.
A huge leap.
It was exhibited at the Andakulova Gallery in Dubai.
I mean, it is difficult to imagine a more massive contextual and environmental clash.
It is the ultimate culture clash.
Yeah.
Picture the potential viewer here. Imagine a wealthy Dubai businessman living on the 80th floor of an ultra-modern, pristine skyscraper.
A completely different world.
Right. His entire environment is climate-controlled. The engineering, the wealth, and the infrastructure of his city have practically eliminated the unexpected variables of the natural world.
He doesn't worry about the tide rising into his living room.
No. And yet this guy is standing in a pristine, sterile gallery, looking at a gritty, highly textured painting of a weathered wooden shack perched over a swamp. How does someone in that environment relate to this piece?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we realize that the Dubai businessman and the resident of the Sinaga Grande share the exact same internal hardware.
What do you mean by hardware?
Our biology. When they face the unknown, their nervous systems generate the exact same knot in the stomach.
Oh, the physical reaction.
Exactly. The monsters they're facing are wildly different. The swamp resident is afraid of the shifting weather patterns and the rising tide.
Right.
But the businessman in Dubai might be terrified of a sudden catastrophic collapse in global financial markets, or he might be sitting in a sterile oncology ward waiting for the results of a looming medical biopsy.
So the environment completely changes, but the waiting room feels exactly the same.
The pause is identical, and there's a beautiful, profound paradox at work here.
What's the paradox?
The intense cultural and geographic specificity of Duke's painting, the worn wooden stilts, the granular, earthy texture of the arch's paper trapping the pigment, the specific cut of the doorway, all of that acts as an anchor, not a barrier.
It draws you in instead of pushing you away.
Right. By being so unflinchingly honest and specific about a highly local reality, the painting becomes a universal communicator.
So he's not painting a documentary about poverty in Colombia. He's using Colombia as the lens to document a shared human condition.
He is capturing the sheer endurance required when life offers you zero guarantees. The hyper-specificity makes the emotion undeniable. And because the emotion is real, a person standing in a desert metropolis can tune into the exact same emotional frequency as a person standing in a tropical swamp.
They recognize the expressive containment.
Exactly.
Man, it really is a masterclass in how to say everything while painting almost nothing happening. We've unpacked so much today.
It's a dense little painting.
It really is. We've explored how an imbalanced, heavy wooden wall on the right side of a composition can physically arrest the viewer's eye and create architectural entrapment.
And we broke down how the microscopic valleys of cold-pressed paper catch heavy, granulating watercolors to literally build the physical grit of wading into the page.
Yeah, that chemistry aspect was fascinating. And we saw how expressive containment, the simple act of leaning your weight quietly against a doorframe, speaks a universal language of anxiety that resonates perfectly from a Colombian lagoon all the way to a skyscraper in Dubai.
It serves as a powerful reminder that the loudest, most overwhelming emotions are very often the quietest visually. The deepest uncertainty doesn't scream, it just stares at the horizon.
I love that. And I want to bring this right back to you, the listener.
Yeah, how does this apply to everyday life?
Exactly. Using Duke's lens of expressive containment, try looking at your own daily environment a little differently today. The person sitting completely silently next to you on the subway commute, or the coworker quietly typing at the desk across from you, they might be internally holding up a massive, heavy wooden wall.
You never really know what someone is dealing with.
Right. They might be enduring their own quiet waiting room, projecting that exact same silent exhaustion and stubborn resistance, completely hidden behind a flat surface.
This raises an important question, though, about how we as a society handle our own waiting rooms today.
It really does, because we live in a modern era that is completely obsessed with metrics, with instant gratification, and with the aggressive illusion of total control over our lives.
We want an app to track every variable and predict every single outcome.
But by constantly surrounding ourselves with these artificial certainties, have we allowed our natural capacity to inhabit the pause? To atrophy.
That is the million-dollar question.
When life inevitably strips away our illusion of control, will we have the internal strength to lean quietly against the doorframe and endure the silence, or will we collapse at the very first gust of wind?